Welcome to Spiritual Naturalism Today, a conversation on science, nature, and spirituality. Our program is sponsored by the Spiritual Naturalist Society with host Daniel Strain.
Hello, and thank you for joining us. I'm Daniel Strain, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Thomas Schenk.
Hello.
And Lee Anderson.
Hello.
And today we're going to be talking about reading as a spiritual practice. Probably a lot of us here, listeners and people at SNS and members, do a lot of reading on our own and everything, but reading as a spiritual practice, you know, I think there's a lot of interesting things to talk about in that. And it should be a fascinating topic. I'm anxious to hear what my co-hosts have to say about it. I've got a few things to talk about on it, and I hope you'll enjoy it. I just want to make a note that this is, as we mentioned in the opening, sponsored by the Spiritual Naturalist Society. You can become a member of the society by going to snsociety.org. That's S as in spiritual, N as in naturalist. Or you can just type out spiritualnaturalistsociety.org. And you'll see a membership option in the top menu, and it'll tell you how you can become a member and get the newsletter, news and updates on everything pertaining to spiritual naturalism. We really could use your support, and we'd love to welcome you into our community. So without further ado, let me go ahead and start us off reading as a spiritual practice. I'd like to start by asking our co-host, how does that work for you? Have you ever considered reading as a spiritual practice, and what do you read and how and why? And what do you think, Lee?
Well, I've been a lifelong reader, and I think when I first started looking into religious and spiritual topics, I would read different books on subjects, basically to get a lot of history and knowledge on them. Sometimes the author's thought processes would make me think, but I think mostly when I was reading books, it was basically to just kind of get an understanding of what the concepts are. And that I did that for probably, I don't know, maybe even a couple of decades or so. But what I've gotten to lately, I try to be a little bit more introspective. And rather than reading books on what other people think about, you know, what their spiritual thoughts on, lately I've been reading either essays or poetries by a lot of writers who kind of just have thoughts on spirituality, but not necessarily a whole process. Right now, my favorite two books, I have one book, it's called Nature Writing, The Tradition in English, and it's basically essays on people going out into nature and what they see and what they think. And of course, it's got all of the your basics, you know, Thoreau and all of that. Because they're essays and because they're shorter, I can sit down and read them, and almost invariably they'll make me want to get up and start walking outside and just think about what I've read. And then the other book that I look to a lot, I struggle with poetry a lot. And so I'm slow at reading it, and it makes me think a lot. But I have a book called Poetry for the Spirit, and it goes all the way back, from like Rumi's writings. It goes through poetry from all the different standard religions and everything like that up to modern day. So again, you know, those are short read articles and everything, but it makes me think, and they are spiritual poems and everything. So what I've incorporated as part of my spiritual reading practice is a daily, what I call attentive reading, where I read either an essay or a poem or something like that, and then really put some thought into thinking about what the author was thinking and then what my own thoughts are on it.
So kind of a combination of reading and journaling then?
Sometimes it does end up being journaling too, yes.
What about you, Thomas? What role does reading play in your life?
Well, I've been quite a reader all my life, but I wanted to Lee had said attentive reading. I call that deep reading. And I think there's two different particular approaches. I mean, there's a lot of reading I do that's just, you know, it's reading. But the idea of this kind of, you know, particularly deep reading of something. And I wanted to actually go back when I started this practice, which was back when I was in college and I was working as a state park naturalist. And Leah talked about getting up and going outside. And I had brought this book with me, Annie Dillard's Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. And I got to live in this park and in this beautiful place. And I would start reading that book and I would read a paragraph or so. And it's a wonderful book about seeing nature and seeing and thinking about it in unusual ways. But it took me the entire summer to read the book because every time I'd pick it up and start reading, I'd get curious and I'd go walk outside and start looking at things. So the book was just great at reminding me to, you know, just to really pay attention to what was going around. So I think that, and I've continued that now. So I'll have books that I try to read them really deeply so that I would, you know, books that are fairly complicated and to try to really penetrate them as deeply as I can. A second kind of approach to this question is something of having a question, just some really big question that that occupies me, where I'll spend maybe several years reading to try to get answers to that question. When I was about 30 years ago, I was walking around in the Redwood Forest in California, and I just started to ask myself this question. We keep talking about nature being beautiful, and I started really wondering from a philosophical point of view what that really could mean. And I got into about a 10-year reading program of reading philosophy and study of nature and just a artist and everything around this one question of what they meant when they would talk about nature being beautiful. And I ultimately had hoped to write something about that, but I finally, after 10 years, came to the conclusion that there really was no answer to that question, that it's like you can answer the question, but it's, my analogy was, it's kind of like killing the butterfly and pinning it up. Whereas if you the beauty of nature is like a living butterfly, and I preferred to just let it live rather than trying to pin it down into some formula or trying to, find some easy answer to that question. But I think the real answer to the question was that there's just a mystery there that that gives life to that beauty. So those are, two of the particular ways that I approach reading as a spiritual practice, one being a deep reading and the other being a long-term, having a question, a particular question that I hope to answer.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting that both of you have that experience of reading something and then wanting to get up and go experience. And it makes me think of the distinction between reading for understanding and reading for experience, especially when you said, Lee, that you're reading poetry. And to me, when I read poetry, it kind of tickles some different areas of the brain than an intellectual kind of book. You're talking now about kind of an intuitive part or emotional. And so then the reading isn't just for studying some kind of philosophic concept, but actually having an experience and then encouraging us to then go out and put that experience into practice or gather that experience in other ways as well. I typically read nonfiction, and I'll read, you know, things about the philosophies that I follow and try to expand out from that. And I mainly tend to read about Taoism, Buddhism, Stoicism. I have in the past read about science and humanism. And so I try to keep all that together. And what I've noticed is that, like, you'll read something and then kind of forget a lot of it. And so what I do now is I have a special bookshelf. And on that bookshelf, I keep books that have had specific kind of impact on me. They don't get to mix in with the regular books. And so it's kind of like my little book altar. And I also have a practice of when I'm reading, I go through it and, you know, I'll mark major points that of importance, and I'll do a little, like, draw a little circle around a section, and then everywhere I have a note, I circle the page number. And so then I can easily later go back and flip through that book and find the circles and then look at just the notes parts to get kind of a recap of the important lessons from that book, just to kind of jog my memory and go back over them again in a quick way. Of course, another option is to read the books again. And, you know, so I find that I continuously have to kind of go back. And then, of course, when you go back, you're reading it now a few years later after you've come to some other things, and it takes on a different shade or a different perspective than it had before. And that's how I typically do it. But I have to say, before we decided on this topic, one of the reasons I thought it was a great idea was that I kind of thought as reading as this, you know, you're getting kind of the intellectual part of it and you're learning in the intellectual sense. And then you go out and you do these practices or rituals or what have you to have the experiential side of that, and they're informed by the intellectual side that you got from the reading. But I'm glad that we're now talking about reading as a spiritual practice, meaning that there are certain ways and certain contexts in which one can read, and it's not just the intellectual fuel for practice, but practice itself. I like what you said about, Thomas, what you said about deep reading too, because I was going to mention a few different points about what makes it different from just regular or plain old reading. And one of the points I was going to mention is, you know, take your time, be mindful and meditative and have concentration as you read, take some time to reflect on what you've read. And I guess that kind of gets at what you're saying with deep reading. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a way of, I think of it as penetrating, you know, like there's things that we're, we expect the author to give us all the information and to digest it for us and present it to us so it's easy to understand. But there's another kind of writing where the author expects us to do a lot of work. And that's when I think about a book that's great for deep reading, and of course, good, you know, a lot of poetry is that way. The poetry is difficult in a way that you have to read it, certainly read it more than once, and to read it in many different ways to fully capture everything that's going on in the piece. The work, you know, so a deep reading is to take a book and, you know, not treat it as something that where you're passive and the author is giving you something, but where you and the author are in a kind of relationship and you're trying to figure out what the author is, you know, is saying. And this is also true, I mean, of not just of poetry, but if anyone's ever tried to read Immanuel Kant, which his Theory of Judgment is one of my favorite books in it, but it's an incredibly difficult book to read, and you just have to you know, the sentences can be so so thick that you've got to just go back and read it many times. So that's really, you know, is the kind of book that I consider ripe for deep reading is one that you simply can't get it. You can't just sit down and read it once and expect to have gotten everything out of it. And you know, that different people would have different kinds of books that they would, you know, consider to be a book that would really require that. But so that, but yeah, that's what I mean by deep reading, I guess. So the distinction between being a passive and being an active participant in the creation of the meaning of the work is what I would really distinguish between deep reading and normal reading.
You know, that really draws out the necessity of a sacred tongue or more poetic style that you find in works like the Bible or in Chuang Tzu or the Zen-like language that's purposely obscured, purposely a little bit vague, because it's trying to stimulate in the reader their part of the work. So that's a great point. And then Lee, for you, when you read poetry, what is your experience with that? And like, what do you get out of the poetry? I mean, that's probably a multi-pronged response, but.
Well, and like I said, what I've been reading is poetry for the spirit. So, you know, it's people like Rumi that have specifically written things that make you think. And I think along with what Thomas was saying about deep reading, you know, when you read a novel, you start off and you get more excited about it and you keep reading because you want to get to the end. Whereas with the deep reading, it may be hard to get through a paragraph and you've got to go back over it, you know, again and again to think about what the author's saying, what it means to you. And I do the same thing you do, Daniel. I underline, I highlight, I write my notes, you know, and that. With poetry, it's more to me, I kind of understand the concept of what the author is trying to get across. But again, because of the ambiguous language, it leaves the interpretation specifically up to me most of the time. So I'm doing more internal thought on what it means to me rather than what it means to the author.
Yeah, that's really great. I mean, that's a perfect example of what the experiential side of ritual and practice are all about, and that's what makes it formative. My wife gets on me about what I do to books with the dog ears and the writing, and she says, "Oh, you're messing up the book." And I kind of believe along the lines of, I can't remember where I heard this, but somebody saying, you know, if someone's a lover of books, then it should show. The book should look worn and used, you know, like you really took it to town, yeah. And,
you're not planning on selling it back to the secondhand bookstore when you're done.
That's true, yeah.
Unless they do want to see your marginalia there, you know. Sometimes to me, that's more valuable than a book that's pristine.
Yeah, so, I like to do that too. And another part of this, I guess you could count it under reflection, is that this is one of the possible roles of a spiritual community is my wife and I, for a while, we're going to this contemplative group at a local Episcopalian church, and we're not Christians, and obviously didn't share all of their beliefs, but this was a group specifically that was a book club for contemplative works, contemplative books, and they looked at you know, Sufi books and all kinds of, you know, they were very cross-sectional like that, which is why we were attracted to the group. And we went and had a great time, and it was a book club, but where you do that same sort of reflection, but now you're seeing what other people think of it. So you get this kind of everybody grabbing a different part of the elephant kind of thing. And that too can be a helpful type of reflection and getting use out of a spiritual community in that sense.
Yeah, I think something that I do also is I read a lot of, I try to read a lot of books from other religions, both to understand what their, you know, what a believer might be getting out of that, but also to do what I call translations, is to see if I can translate it into a naturalistic, an understanding that it doesn't require supernaturalism, which is mm-hmm. kind of the way I think of natural, because I tend to probably am more open to those things than some people who call themselves naturalist, but to just see if I can, you know, see that in a way that I can understand it without requiring any supernatural. And that's another, that's kind of an interesting way. And I usually find that I can, you know, I mean, if with the really good, I mean, some, you know, someone like a Thomas Merton or, you know, the more, what I would call the more sophisticated, religious writers. Although yeah. I've been rereading William James' Variety of Religious Experience and having kind of fun looking at some of those the things that he writes of the different pieces that he's reading from that he didn't write but that other people have written and finding ways of seeing if I can understand those in a naturalistic way also, which is so it's actually really a great book, I think. Anyone who's really interested in religion, I think, kind of needs to read that book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. That is a biggie. So the process you talk about was another, I think you and I are thinking on very similar lines, because that was another one of the things on my notes that I wanted to mention, is that, you know, I think a lot of these, if a book is about a spiritual practice or a tradition, then I think it's very helpful. You know, you open it up and you say, oh, what is this nonsense? Let's see about this. You know, if you got that kind of an attitude about it, it's going to be an impediment to really deep understanding of what they're saying. And so I think it takes this willingness to be tolerant and charitable in your interpretation. So, you know, if somebody says something and it's kind of, you're not real sure how they mean that, maybe it's not that important to take it in the worst way. Maybe it's okay to take it in a way that makes sense to you, because then you could find the truth in it. And on points of skepticism or disagreement, you know, you can think about alternatives. What can you, you know, because obviously the author of this, regardless of what their beliefs are, there was something in it they were seeing. There was some kind of truth somewhere that they were sensing or feeling that had an effect for them, you know, and by getting to the bottom of that, it's not so much a debunking as it is a deeper understanding. And so some people, you know, they, for example, on the subject of karma, you know, some people, they want to have a very supernatural kind of interpretation of it. And they do have that kind of understanding of it or that belief about it. And then other people say, well, I find some usefulness to the concept of thinking about how my actions create these ripples of causes and effects throughout the world, and what kinds of actions are beneficial and what kinds are harmful. And I don't necessarily have to interpret it as a literal kind of thing or a magical kind of thing. I can have my own interpretation about it. Or, for example, the subject of intuition. What does intuition mean? You know, some people think about it like some kind of psychic power or something. Other people look at it like, well, your mind is assimilating a lot of complex data and you're not necessarily conscious of how it's putting it all together, but there's something more than just imagination going on there. Yeah, I think that the kind of open, tolerant willingness to explore other ideas, and then a confidence that you're not going to get just brainwashed without an ability to come back to who you are and then reflect on it from the position of your own views, you know, a confidence in your own ability to discern is maybe necessary to that kind of tolerance.
I love the term charitable reading, because we obviously, there's a lot of people out there, particularly on the internet, who do not seem to have that concept of charitable reading, who read with the desire to, you know, to just be snarky about it.
Or just to support the ideas that they already have.
Right.
So they're not learning anything new. They're looking for that data that will support what they already know. I like that too, because like I said, I like to read essays and shorter things for the attentive reading that I do. But because we're spiritual naturalists, I also like to always keep up with latest science findings and, you know, even technology and things like that, because a lot of the things that come to light, you know, support what we already kind of practice and may not have scientific background for. But like recently when Cal Newport wrote the book on deep work, and that right there was the whole idea of stopping to really engage with what you're doing. He talks about work, you know, we're talking about reading here and everything, but it was a lot of scientific data to kind of support this whole idea of, you know, just doing your deep reading, your deep thoughts, your deep work, and that helps you ingrain those types of ideas and things.
Yeah, that's a great point. And, you know, combining these things, you know, trying to find a way to say, okay, this is what we understand about the world today, but why is it that people benefited from these other ideas? You know, what's the real truth going on there? How can we understand this more deeply in a consistent way? That's a great, great point. I think there's also some practicality things maybe we should discuss that have to do with, you know, a person's schedule in life. Like, you know, if you really want to make reading part of your practice, like any other practice, I think it'd be a good idea to make conscious setting aside of time for reading, because right now a lot of people don't get a lot of time to read other than Facebook posts, you know, and setting aside time to just sit there with a book can be really important if you want that to be part of your... I remember when I first started my delving into spiritual practices, I would set a routine in the mornings, and one part of that routine, it involved a few things, exercise, meditation, things, but one part of that routine was sitting and reading for... until I'd set a timer, you know, and I had a thoughtful process about what I was reading as my study program or whatever, and I would sit there and read for that time period every day. And because I viewed it as kind of this, you know, food for thought, fuel for my practice, because there's so much work and knowledge and creativity and thought that humanity has produced over the course of history, we might end up trying to reinvent the wheel and doing a very shallow, poor job of it in just one human lifetime if we don't make time for that kind of absorption, I think.
Yeah, when I was working full-time and taking classes in the evening, and so I had required reading. Like I said, I was working full-time, but reading for my own enrichment, you know, was so important at the time that I remember I started waking up at 4:30 in the morning just so that I could spend 45 minutes or so reading each day, you know, the books that I had on my list, like you said, you had on your list. And to this day, I still make sure, like I said, that I carve out time to read for enrichment. basically, is what the attentive reading is.
Yeah, sometimes like we'll combine it too. Like Julie and I want to spend time together, so we'll get our books and we'll go to a coffee shop and we'll sit there with our coffee. And even though, you know, only in between once in a while are we actually talking to each other, we're still having quality time together and we're both getting our reading. And, you know, of course, in between, oh, hey, listen to this, blah, 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 you know, and then a little bit of reflection in there too, you know, so you can like synergize these things together if you have a really busy schedule. And of course, we could all stand to have more quality time with loved ones, of course. Appropriate setting is another one of those practicality measures I was going to bring up along with making time. You know, don't do it with the TV on and stuff like that, you know, kind of almost like creating a sacred space. We've talked about sacred spaces before. So along with that, making time, making space, having a good setting for your reading can be very crucial to getting in that deep state that you talked about.
I was just going to, since it seems we've ignored fiction to some extent, and I just wanted to bring in, because I think reading fiction, I mean, there's all kinds of fiction. There's very, you know, fairly easy to read fiction. And then again, there's fiction that requires very deep reading. I've been working my way through the Virginia Woolf novels, and I just finished To the Lighthouse, and which is a beautiful, beautiful novel. But I think the difference, you know, you can read about the world, you know, like stuff on science or natural history. But if you want to really read about people in a really deep way, to get that kind of penetration of human motivation and how the best, you know, there's all these different kinds of people that that are living in the world, I think there's nothing like fiction. And that's what I really enjoy about Virginia Woolf, outside of the fact that she's such an incredible stylist, is that she just has this incredible penetration into human thought and human motivation, that human memory and what past thoughts do to us, and just this whole the whole depth there. So I think it is good to mix in, you know, quality fiction in anybody's reading schedule.
I agree with you completely. You're trying to get through Virginia Woolf. I'm trying to get through Infinite Jest right now. David,
I gave up on that one.
Yeah, that one's slow going.
That's a great point about fiction. You know, I love science fiction, right? So stories like this can take abstract principles or even social situations and pull them out of the trappings that we normally think of them in and put them into a different setting. And so by doing so, it highlights certain underlying truths or principles or reasoning in those kinds of situations that we don't appreciate because we're caught up in it. It's like a colloquial issue, or, you know, it's like a partisan issue, for example, and they can take those and they can either show you how it affects an individual. Like, for example, I think that the gay rights movement was greatly bolstered and accelerated by the inclusion of gay characters in fiction, not just books, of course, but shows and TV and movies. And when you have the experience of other people's, putting yourself in their shoes through fiction, you get this experiential sort of grokking of an idea that you wouldn't get otherwise if it was just explained philosophically.
And I'm going to, the word grokking that you use, which comes out of the, I believe it's Stranger in a Strange Land, so that shows a little bit of your science fiction.
Yeah, grokking is a useful word. And Robert Heinlein, my wife Julie introduced me to that. And grokking is this, it's like getting understanding, but on a very deep intuitive level. And I don't think, you know, I know people in my family who would have been like, oh, those gays this and gays that, or this and that people or race, whatever. But when you get to know a specific person in your life, then, or an atheist, for example, then it takes on a whole different thing. Then it that ceases to become just a group. And for people that don't have a gay in their life or a African-American in their life or whatever, you can have a story, and then they're reading this, and now they're in their shoes, and it helps to break down that barrier a little bit. That's a wonderful function of, but it also works for abstract philosophical principles and spiritual ideas and everything.
During the past week, my wife and I had actually a very interesting trip that was related to her reading. I actually wasn't that interested in the trip, but I got kind of interested. So we went out, she was reading the Laura Ingalls Wilder books, and we live up in, you know, I actually was born close to one of the towns she lived in. So we went to a couple of the sites that are where her books have been written, Walnut Grove and DeSmet, South Dakota. And I got quite interested because, you know, just seeing these sites, thinking about these incredible experiences, the hardships, seeing where they actually lived and the kind of like, you know, these actual properties, and, you know, actually going in the houses that the Ingalls built out on the prairie. And I hadn't even thought about that in terms of this topic, but that was actually a really interesting way that reading had gotten us involved in but what really, you know, just thinking about those people and just that, you know, that connection to the land. And there's some negatives in there, I think, too, that of the kind of the mythology that goes on in that. But on the whole, just to think about that kind of the hardships that what we take so for granted, you know, is in the comforts of our home, and that those things were absolutely missing for years in their lives, that they had none of that. So
I recently finished Killers of the Flower Moon, which was the story of the Osage Indians in Oklahoma and the beginnings of the FBI. And my family had been in Oklahoma about that time. And we were always kind of proud of the fact that one of them was a sheriff, you know, in one of those small towns. And now after reading the book, I want to go back out there because I'm almost afraid that, you know, my ancestors were probably some of the people who benefited from, you know, the downfall of the Osage Indians and stealing their millions of dollars and things, which is what the book was about. So, yeah, I'm planning on some trips of my own, too, because of my reading.
What a great example of how books can help raise our mindfulness and awareness of where we've come from, and who we are, and where we are in society, and our responsibilities, and our lifestyles, and everything. And all of that, of course, is key to a spiritual practice. I just really love the points you all have made here. So what effect do you think reading has had on you in terms of kind of spiritual development?
In a lot of societies, you know, if a person's going to get introduced to Buddhism or such things, they will get through a teacher, whereas I came to all of those things through books. And so my whole, you know, the whole way I got into kind of got away from the Catholicism that I was brought up in and moved into different directions was inspired by books. I had this very interesting experience when I was about 13 years old, and I was visiting my dad, who was at that time was living in the cities. And I just had gone into this bookstore, and I found this little book called The Secret Oral Teachings of Tibetan Buddhist Sects, which was written by Alexandra David Neal. And I just opened it to a page, and on the first sentence I read was this, it was the master, the head of the monastery, telling his students, doubt everything I say. And this was such an incredible revelation to me to hear a religious person say to his pupils, doubt everything I say, because I had come from this tradition where it was, accept what I say or I'm going to wrap you on the wrist, you know? And it just, that book really was a turning point in my life. That was the book that it kind of got me not only into Buddhism, but it helped me find a way to move from, you know, the religious upbringing I had to something that meant a lot more to me, but without, you know, without there having to be a complete, you know, split in, so that there was a transition. I was able to transition into something that was, was very meaningful. And in the early days, I always had to depend on books because it was the only way access I had. Eventually, I did find some teachers and whatnot, but I think most of us are in that situation, which is not probably always the healthiest thing, but that's just our necessity, is very often we have to come to these things through books.
Yeah, it's our gateway. What about you, Lee?
Well, I grew up in it was fairly non-religious family. If we did any kind of going to church or anything, it was going to be a Christian church. And I think I was pretty young, too, when I figured out the same thing that Thomas was alluding to. If I went to a Christian church, they were more or less telling me what I should or shouldn't read. But in my household, we were allowed to read whatever we wanted to read. I remember at a very young age just like reading The Godfather and Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee and, you know, just tomes like that. And so when I would hear that there was either a banned book or that some certain church didn't want you to read something, I immediately went and got the book. You know, and I started reading. And it just opened up my eyes to, you know, so many things. So I started learning about Hinduism and Buddhism and, you know, things that nobody else was talking about. And I found that it was just such a diverse world of, you know, the mythology or the stories that each of the religions were telling. But then you could find books that found the commonalities in all of them. And so it just started that lifelong trek, you know, of learning about all that. So I finally got to the point, though, which I think is why I read the shorter essays right now, of realizing that even at best, even at the books that I really love, the author had a goal. And what I was seeing was what they wanted me to see. And so I just learned not to accept kind of anything too much at first, at face value, but to try and do my own thinking and my own research and everything. So that's basically books, as far as my spiritual outlook, have basically pretty much given me everything, because I try to get something out of them that I don't already know and think about it and then add that to my repertoire.
Oh, that's wonderful. Like you guys, books have been my main vehicle into things starting out. And my first involvement with Buddhism came because I was reading about it first on websites and whatnot, and then books. And then after I read the books, but eventually I got to a point where it's like, okay, I need to interact with people about this. I need to go and, you know, meet some monks and talk to them and see what they think and practice with some other people and see if I'm doing it right. Cause you know, you're reading in a vacuum and you don't know if you're really understanding. But I don't think I would have gotten there if I hadn't had engaged in the reading in an earnest way at the beginning and really try to open myself up to it. These are some really fascinating stuff. I'd love to hear what our audience thinks about it. And of course, we produce quite a bit of writing. Thomas is our editor and oversees the, we've got a team of authors that put out articles through the society, and we also host a lot of other writing on our website that can be read. And so feel free to check those out. That might give some people some ideas on where to start or what they might want to look at. Any closing words as we wrap up here?
My practice in the morning is usually involves meditation, journaling, and the reading. And then So in this ever evolving talk we're having here, I'm now thinking about maybe I should meditate after I read in order to really help incorporate it. But again, that just kind of proves it's always an evolving process.
Yeah, I could see it both ways, because there's different kinds of meditation. There's a contemplative type of meditation where you're actually dealing with a subject matter, like an introspective kind of meditation. That would be good to follow reading. Whereas the mindfulness meditation or meditation on the breath, Vipassana, or that sort of meditation, that's good for honing your focus and attention and stilling the mind. And I would recommend putting that before the reading. So you do like a breathing meditation, still the mind, get your focus, then do the reading, and you'll find you can get really deep into it. And then you could do a meditation that's more of a contemplation, reflection on that content. Really different kinds of things, but that might make a good sequence.
That's a good question.
That's typically what I would do is that combination, and starting with I guess I call dhyana from the Hindu or from the Sanskrit term for meditation, and then go to a contemplation.
Interesting. Okay. Well, cool. I really enjoyed this conversation, and thought it was a great subject for us to broach. And so until next time, please check out our past episodes if you haven't listened to those, and we'll see you again for a future episode. Take care. Bye-bye.
This program was sponsored by the Spiritual Naturalist Society. Learn more and become a member at spiritualnaturalistsociety.org. Our music was composed by John Clemisrud. Please share our program and join us next time on Spiritual Naturalism Today.